The last things, what theologians call eschatology, from eschatos, meaning the end. We read two passages, first of all from Matthew 24 at verse 32, and Christians generally believe that when Christ speaks about the fig tree here, he's speaking about the restoration of the Jewish nation. The fig tree is a parable of the Jews. And so in verses 32 and from verses 32 to 35, Christ says that when the Jewish nation begins to be revived and restored, then you'll know that the end of the age is near. From verse 32. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. And so also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation, this age, will not pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But of that day and hour of the second coming, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. As were the days of Noah. Now, the days of Noah were secular days. People were just going about their ordinary secular business, their secular lives. For as in those days before the flood, as were the days of Noah, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they did not know until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two men will be in the field, one is taken and one is left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One is taken and one is left. Watch therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the householder had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have watched and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. And in chapter 25, at verse 1, the parable of the bridesmaids. Then the kingdom of heaven shall be compared to 10 maidens who took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish, and five were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, "Behold, the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those maidens rose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." Borrowed religion, second-hand religion, somebody else's religion that you've borrowed from. "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise replied, Perhaps there will not be enough for us and for you. Go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast. And the door was shut. Afterward, the other maidens came also saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he replied, Truly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. Then God will add a blessing to his own word, to his name, be honor and praise. In our series of morning messages on basic Christian teaching, we start this morning another smaller series on the last things. The end of the age, the second coming of Christ, the general resurrection, the last judgment, heaven and hell, and so on. In fact, the Bible treats these events in the way in which an artist would paint on a very large canvas. History, according to the Bible, is divided into two parts. The first world was the world before Noah, the world that ended in the flood. That first world was destroyed in a judgment of water. The second world is the world we live in, the world after the flood, and this world is to be destroyed in a judgment of fire. First world ends in water, the second world, our world, ends in fire. If I can quote unforgettable words from Peter's second letter. The world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. But the heavens and earth that now exist have been stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and the destruction of ungodly men. For the day of the Lord comes like a thief in the night, and the heavens will pass away with a loud noise, and the elements will be dissolved with fire, and the earth and the works that are upon it will be burned up. The heavens will be kindled and dissolved, and the elements will melt with fire. Now, perhaps you think it's strange that we should be embarking on a study of the last things when we are just about to head for Christmas. Why should we now dwell on the second coming when we are about to think of the first coming? Round about Christmas time, we normally think of the coming of Christ in humiliation at Bethlehem. Why then should we now think of his second coming in majesty and glory at the end of the age? Well, there is very good precedent for this in the Christian church. It was always an ancient custom in the churches, right through the season of Advent, leading up to Christmas, to think not so much of Christmas as of the real Christmas, the final coming of Jesus Christ. If you know the ceremony of nine lessons and carols that comes every year, broadcast from King's College Chapel in Cambridge, you will recall that the goal of that service and the climax of that service of carols is not so much Bethlehem as the second coming. And in fact, this is something that you find at the heart of many of our familiar hymns and carols. At Christmas time, we'll be singing these words. Our God, heaven cannot hold him, nor earth sustain. Heaven and earth shall flee away when he comes to reign. You see, the message is not so much Christmas, but the real Christmas when Christ comes. And our eyes at last shall see him through his own redeeming love, not in that poor lowly stable. And our eyes at last shall see him, not in that poor lowly stable with the oxen standing by. We shall see him, but in heaven, set at God's right hand on high. The first Christmas is a prelude to the real Christmas. Not only so, Jesus Christ himself encourages us to think about the last things, because he was forever speaking about the last things, particularly towards the close of his earthly ministry. He spoke about the dissolution of the world, the disintegration of the universe on a day of judgment, the day of reckoning, and the everlasting destinies of men and women. For example, in Matthew chapter 22, he taught the parable of the great wedding feast and the guests who were not disposed to come. In Matthew chapter 24, you have what's called the great apocalypse, from the Greek word apokalypsis, which means unveiling, the great unveiling of Christ at the end of the age, Matthew 24. Then in Matthew 25, you have the parable of the 10 bridesmaids. 5 were wise and ready, 5 were foolish and quite unprepared for the coming of the bridegroom. Later on, in Matthew 25, you have the parable of the talents and the servant who wasted his time and wasted his life, and then the Lord came. Later on, in Matthew 25, you have the most terrible parable that Jesus ever told, the parable of the sheep and the goats, and the great separation of men on the day of judgment. Jesus insists on this, that we think of it. But more than this, not only does Jesus insist that we think about the last things, the New Testament teaches that the second coming of Christ is bound up with our very constitution as Christians. What is a Christian? Well, it's easy. A Christian is 4 things. Someone who has been saved by grace, saved through faith, saved from the corruption that is in the world through lust, and fourthly, saved into the hope of the second coming of Christ. Paul says in Romans 8, it is into this hope, the coming of Christ, it is into this hope that we've been saved. Saved by grace, watch the prepositions, by grace, through faith, from corruption, into the hope of the second coming of Christ. And because Jesus invites us to consider these things, and because the churches have always linked Advent with the last coming of Christ, and because the coming of Christ is something into which Christians have been saved, Christianity is not just a way of salvation, of course it's that first of all, but it's more than a way of salvation. It's a philosophy of life. It's a way of looking at the world, its history, its destiny. It's a way of looking at the nature and the destiny of men. And in fact, still painting this on a broad canvas, this is something that distinguishes the gospel from some of its rivals in the world today. You know, of course, that the message of Jesus Christ is surrounded today with rivals and all sorts of alternative theories and alternative philosophies. But it's what Christ has to say on the last things that makes Christianity so distinctive. If I can just give you three illustrations of this. Buddhism, which is a minor rival of Christianity, but it's becoming very fashionable. There are now Buddhist temples in Britain. Buddhism says there are no last things. When you die, you're finished. But your soul drifts into nirvana, which means nothingness, or non-existence, or non-being. In other words, you just disappear. There are no last things. When you die, you just vanish. Hinduism, which is another minor rival of Christianity, says there are no last things. When you die, you don't die. You're reborn. Incarnation, reincarnation. You come back again. That's karma. The circle of fate. The circle of birth, death, rebirth, life, death, rebirth, karma. And it goes on like that forever and ever and ever and ever. There are no last things. Marxism, which is a major rival of the gospel, also says there are no last things. Not only are there no last things, there is no God. There is no Jesus to come back again. There is no life after death. The world is going to go on forever, like the road in the children's address. When you come to the end of one age, there's another age ahead of you. When you come to the end of that age, there's another age ahead of you. The universe is going to go on forever and ever and ever. And so man does not need a God to be a savior and a judge, because man is his own savior and his own judge. Now, it is over against these rivals that Jesus says, one day the world will end. The last sermon will be preached. The last psalm will be sung. The last Bible will be closed. The last offer will be made to sinners. And I will come again. And when I come, that will be the end of everything as we've known it. All the churches and the cathedrals, all the banks and the stock exchanges, all the art galleries and the palaces of culture, the houses of parliament, universities, seats of learning, the Kremlin, Paris, Hollywood, Peking, the Pentagon, they are all to be burned. And out of the ashes, God will reconstitute the universe. The Apostle John speaks about a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwell. This is what Jesus called the regeneration, the making of all things new. I will come again. These are the cardinal words. This same Jesus, says Luke at the start of Acts, this same Jesus will also come again. The second coming is the center round which all the realities of the last things revolve. Now, if there is time, well, actually this morning, I just want to give you this broad canvas. If there is time in the following weeks, we can think about perhaps three of the things that are associated with the coming of Christ. The first is the appearance of the Antichrist, called the man of sin, also called the son of perdition, because it seems to be the teaching of the New Testament that what we are heading for in history is world government with a world ruler and a world religion and a world church and suffering for any Christian who challenges the system. A sort of religious system combined with a political system, ruling the world with real Christians, a tiny persecuted remnant. Indeed, Revelation goes so far as to suggest that the day is coming when organized religion, as we know it, with churches and so on, will come to an end. The appearance of the Antichrist. Along with that, you have the second great reality, which is called the Great Tribulation, a time of unusual suffering for Christians at the end of the age. Christians being persecuted and Christians being pressurized. It's happening already. What the Greek calls phlipsis. That's phlipsis. Pressure. Forces pushing against each other. The Great Tribulation, what the New Testament calls the tribulation, the great one, a special one at the end of the age. The third great reality, the appearance of the Antichrist, the Great Tribulation, is of course the conversion of the Jews. All Israel shall be saved, says Paul in Romans. If the rejection of the Jews throughout history has meant salvation for us Gentiles, what will the ingathering of the Jews be but life from the dead? The Christian church is going to have a kind of resurrection at the end of the age when the Jews recognize Jesus as their real Messiah and the real Christ. This is what many Christians call the better times. If you have any friends in the Free Presbyterian Church, the Free Presbyterians are always very fond of speaking about the better times. Now, the better times they have in mind are the better times that will come on the church when the Jews recognize Jesus as their Messiah and King. Now, that is the broad canvas of the last things. Now, I want in closing to say two very quick words about the two parables we read in Matthew. They're very unlike each other. The one is about a burglar breaking into a house. If the householder had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have watched and would not have let his house be broken into. The one's the story of a burglary. The other is the story of bridesmaids waiting for the bridegroom. Two things, two messages, in common. The first is this. When Christ comes, his coming will awaken men to a sense of things as they really are. When the burglar breaks in, his coming revealed to the people in the house how utterly unready they were for such an emergency. They were living in the house and they imagined that they were secure, that they were safe, that they were inviolable. Burglaries happen to other people. You ever noticed that? Like airplane smashes. They happen to other people. You notice that? But the burglar got in And suddenly the people were awake to the state of things as they really were. They were not ready for his coming. And it was so with the bridesmaids. What did these silly bridesmaids learn when the bridegroom came? I'll tell you. They learned that at heart they were just actresses. They were not really interested in the bridegroom. They were interested in the trimmings. They liked dressing up in pretty frocks. They liked dressing up as bridesmaid. They enjoyed playing a part. But at heart, they were just actresses with no real interest in the bridegroom. Is your life secure against the second coming? When Christ comes, will that be a shock to you? Will you be embarrassed? Are you like the people living in this house that was burgled, imagining themselves to be safe and fundamentally all right? Or is there somebody here this morning who, like the foolish bridesmaids, is interested in religion only for the trimmings? It's great fun to dress up and put on an act, isn't it? But when Christ comes, his coming will show that there are actors and actresses in the church. He brings us all to a sense of reality. Secondly and lastly, there is the element of surprise. No one knows when a burglar is coming. No one knows when the bridegroom is coming. Not even the Son himself knows. The angels in heaven do not know. Only the Father knows. And this means that at any moment, eternity may come crashing through into our lives, and life as we've lived it will come to an end. All our plans, our projects, all our sermons, all our hopes and desires, all our loves, our ambitions, our schemes, suddenly we will find ourselves confronted with that face which C.S. Lewis calls the joy or the terror of the universe. You'll be lying in bed asleep. You'll be washing the dishes. You'll be lighting up the next cigarette. You'll be pouring out the next glass of lager. You'll be gazing at some rubbish or another on the television, maybe when you should have been doing something more profitable. You may even be listening to a sermon on the second coming. And suddenly, it will be there. That face that is the joy or the terror of the universe. As I said to the children, there will only be one question to be answered then. Do you or do you not belong to him? I'd like to close with some words that I've quoted before from a sermon by Helmut Thielicke, one of the great German preachers in Hamburg, a man who defied Hitler and the Nazis during the war, and who now has survived to preach to immense congregations, sometimes 6,000. At the crossroads where we find ourselves today, we must decide where and to whom we want to belong for time and eternity. At the crossroads, Christ hangs like a beacon on his cross. At the crossroads between heaven and hell hangs Jesus Christ. He hangs there as a sign that the way to life is still open, that the acceptable time is still here, that the hour of visitation is not yet over, and that the Father is still waiting for us. God said to the rich fool, "This night your soul is required of you. This night will God require of you your life. Who are you? Where do you stand? Tonight. Tonight." Amen. May God bless the preaching of his word.